read this 1, 2, 3 or?
Yeah, you want to block the thing before. You remember how you
were. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The sound is not.
Oh.
I turned yours on.
Okay. Did you turn this on? You remember you had something turned off.
I turned this. No, no. You're good there. I didn't turn this
turn
one on.
Turn that on. Okay.
And I didn't plug it in either, so look at this. So this is on now. And it needs to be plugged in.
Oh, it plugs out of there, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, that's where you... Where you put it on the same stuff with the video, I guess, huh?
Set?
Yes.
1, 2, 3.
Good afternoon. We're continuing a 12-part series course, if you like, on the Synoptic Gospels. In our first sessions, which we might call Unit 1, we looked at the historical Jesus and basically a tour of a very quick sketch of some non-Christian views of Jesus, and then of some claimed historical views of Jesus, which basically fell in the category of theological liberalism of one sort or another. And then at the end, pointed out where that was headed, looked a little bit at the arguments used for such position against the miraculous, and then tried to respond to those. We now move on to a second unit, which is rather different but also relevant to the whole matter of the Synoptic Gospels, and that's looking at the Jewish background of the New Testament. To understand the New Testament, especially the Gospels, it's helpful to know a good deal about the Old Testament, but it's also helpful to know something of what went on during the 4 centuries that separate the end of the Old Testament narrative from the beginning of the New Testament narrative. It is this latter that we wish to look at here, called in Christian circles the Intertestament period, but understandably in Jewish circles not called the Intertestament period. They typically call it the Second Temple period. So we want to think a little bit first about what ancient sources of information we have regarding the Intertestament period. And we have, first of all, some predictive passages in the Old Testament, and I'm going to come back in just a couple minutes and take a look at Daniel's overview of the period, sketched in terms of the image that Daniel sees in Daniel chapter 2, and then the Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the wild beasts in Daniel chapter 7, I believe that is. Besides that, we have some religious writings of the Jews, mostly during the Intertestament period, that we call the Old Testament Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. Have been accepted by some Christian churches as a part of the Bible. Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox Church accept the material we call the Old Testament Apocrypha, and some of the smaller regional churches, Ethiopic Church and such, have accepted some of the other material that we now call the Old Testament Pseudepigrapha. So religious writings of the Jews, mostly during the Intertestament period, though we don't believe that they are inspired writings, they do give us some insight into the culture, the religious ideas of some of the sects, and some of the biblical interpretation of the period, and so would be helpful in that direction. Besides that, we have 2 individual writers that we know by name and approximate dates that give us information on this period, and that is Philo of Alexandria, born perhaps around 20 B.C., and lived past 40 A.D., a Jewish person living in the a large Greek city in the northern delta of the Nile called Alexandria. This particular Jew would be what we call a Hellenistic Jew, had adopted a great deal of the Greek culture. He had studied Greek philosophy, and yet he was trying to be faithful to the Bible as well, so he tried to combine the Old Testament with selected ideas from Greek philosophy. We see some partial accommodation to Hellenism there. In his position, he speaks of people who accommodated far more strongly than he did, He had a tendency to allegorize a lot of the laws, but he felt you should obey them, whereas there were other Hellenistic Jews who thought that having allegorized the laws, you did not need to obey them literally. So he would be a moderate Hellenist, if you like. Moving north from him up to the Jerusalem area, we have the individual Josephus, or often known as Flavius Josephus, though that's his Latin name. He was born in 37 A.D. and lived to sometime after 100 A.D. He would have been less Hellenized. He was a Jew involved on both sides of the Jewish War, 66 to 73, the revolt against Rome, which had rather disastrous consequences. Started out on the Jewish side, though he had visited Rome before that time, and perhaps did not feel too optimistic about the chances of the Jews against Rome. But when he, as a general for the defense of Galilee, was surrounded in the city of Jotapata by a Roman army, he and some others hid and drew straws for who would kill who. They were going to commit suicide. And somehow Josephus wound up with the best or next to best straw and convinced the one other guy who was still alive at that point that they should give themselves up to the Jews, give themselves up to the Romans. When they did that, Josephus said, "I have a message from God for the Roman general Vespasian." And when Vespasian heard him, Josephus said, "God has told me that you're going to be the emperor of Rome." Well, Vespasian kept Josephus alive to see whether that would turn out to be true or not. And perhaps he was influenced by Josephus' prediction as well. And lo and behold, with some work of his own, he did wind up being the emperor in the course of the next two or three years. And so Josephus, who had become a slave and being captured and could have been put to death, and probably would have been put to death otherwise, was now made a freedman and released. And in the course of about 10 years after that, he accommodated his patron, Vespasian, by writing a history of the Jewish War. So writing about 80-something A.D., he wrote the Jewish War. And then about 25 years after that, he wrote a work called Antiquities of the Jews. Now, Josephus' Jewish War starts about the time of Alexander and then comes up to the end of the Jewish War. And the Antiquities goes all the way back to Genesis, kind of retells the Old Testament with some additions here and there, and comes up to the outbreak of the Jewish War. So two very important writings, both of which cover the Intertestament period. Besides the predictive passages in the Old Testament, the Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, Philo, and Josephus, we also have the very famous Dead Sea Scrolls, which is literature written or copied by a sect that had headquarters, at least an important encampment, if you like, of their group at the place we call Qumran, perhaps 20 miles southeast of Jerusalem, something like that. We think it was probably some sort of the Essenes, seemed to match in many, many ways. And, of course, a great deal of what we have there are basically copies of scripture that they had kept, and therefore some of the very earliest copies we have of the different books of the Bible in Hebrew, but also some of their own literature, and also some literature which may or may not have been their own, some of the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, both Enoch and Jubilees, have been found fragmentary there anyway in Hebrew. So their own literature, at least, gives us some information about that particular sect, how they interpreted the Bible, things of that sort. From later period, starting perhaps 200 A.D. and running on to maybe 600 A.D. or so, we have the rabbinic literature, which is the writing down of what we might think of as the tradition of the rabbis, the tradition of the Pharisees even, the sort of thing that Jesus speaks about, but which is probably totally in oral form at Jesus' own ministry, but came to be written down in the earliest part, the Mishnah about 200 A.D., and the Talmuds, one about 400 and one about 550. Those are all compilations, if you like, of the oral tradition of the rabbis. And then some biblical translation, paraphrases, commentaries, etc., Midrashim. Those give us some important information as well. So those are our basic ancient sources of information on the Intertestament period. We want to turn next to have a quick look at Daniel's overview of the period, because we will use this as sort of part of our way to structure our discussion of the Intertestament period. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel is given a vision in which he sees a strange statue. It's a statue that in verse 32 is described as having a head of gold, and then its breast and arms, or the upper body, if you like, in verse 32 is described as being made of silver. Its belly and sides, in the same verse, described as being of bronze. Its legs of iron, verse 33. And then its feet, part iron, part clay, verse 33. And then the action that we see in this, after a description of this image, we have one brief action that a stone cut without hands falls down and smashes the image, and then grinds it to a powder, and then the stone grows to fill the whole earth. In the image is explained in chapter 2, verses 38 to 45. We're told in 45 that the image and the action tell us something will happen after Daniel's time. And then in verse 38, that Nebuchadnezzar's universal rule is represented by the golden head. In verse 39, there'll be another kingdom inferior, maybe that's what is, lower down is actually the word, so it might just be a physical statement of this is further down. But the fact that you switch from gold to silver, which has universally been a cheaper metal than gold, may suggest inferior in some way. Suggesting that the head represents not just Nebuchadnezzar personally, but that empire, if you like, the successor empire represented by the silver. A third kingdom to rule over all the earth, we're told in verse 39, is represented by the bronze. A fourth kingdom, strong as iron, so that's clearly the iron legs, is going to be following that. And then in verses 41 through 43, you get a little remark about the feet. Doesn't suggest it's a fifth kingdom, so it's apparently a continuation of the fourth, which would fit with the iron legs going into iron and clay feet, but the part strong, the iron, and part broken, the clay, presumably, which is, I presume, here to be baked clay at this point, not wet clay. And then the stone falling and it smashing the rest and growing is explained in verse 44, God will set up a permanent kingdom. Rather parallel to that, we have Daniel's four wild animals in Daniel chapter 7. Here, this is actually a dream that Daniel had. The other one, which I didn't mention, was actually a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had had. Here, a group of animals are pictured in chapter 7, verses 3 through 14, and then a few more details are scattered through the explanation in verses 19, 20, 21, 23. We're told, first of all, that there will be diverse beasts that will arise from the sea, in verse 3. That the first of these is a lion with eagle's wings, but then the eagle's wings are plucked, and the animal's lifted up, presumably on its hind feet, and is given a human heart, verse 4. Then the second beast is a bear. It's raised up on one side, and since we're not there to see it, don't know exactly what that looks like, perhaps tilted like that or something. And it's gnawing on three ribs, which are in its mouth. Then in verse 6, we're told that the third beast is a leopard, but it's a strange one. It's got four wings and it's got four heads. And then in verses 7 and 8, and then with further in the explanation, we're told of a fourth dreadful, terrible beast with iron teeth and bronze claws and ten horns. And then an 11th horn comes up and it wars against the saints. In verses 9 through 14, we're told that the Ancient of Days comes, apparently a picture of God, and that thrones are set up, and that the fourth beast is destroyed, and his dominion is given to one like a son of man who comes and presents himself before the Ancient of Days, and he's given an eternal universal kingdom. In verses 17 through 26, the animals are explained, but very quickly. In verse 17, we're told that the four beasts represent four kings who will arise from the earth. And as you go on through the discussion, it's clear that kings and kingdoms are being used interchangeably. The fourth kingdom is pictured as diverse from the others. We're told that its horns represent kings, and that the 11th horn wears out the saints for times and half a time, presumably three and a half times. Some discussion of that. And then the Son of Man receiving the kingdom, etc., where is explained as the saints will take the kingdom and possess it forever. Well, those are the two visions, if you like, in chapters 2 and 7 of Daniel. The general interpretation over the centuries, though it's been modified some by theological liberalism in the last couple centuries, is that the kingdoms represented are Babylon, which operates from about 609 when the Babylonians destroy the Assyrian kingdom, down to 539 when Cyrus takes the Babylonians, and he succeeds with his kingdom, which is a combined kingdom of his own kingdom, Persia, with the Medes that he had joined with. And they rule over Israel from 539 to 331 B.C., and then Greece, 331 B.C. to 30 B.C., and then Rome, 30 B.C. to 476 A.D. And so in the image, the gold head represents Babylon, the silver arms and breast represent Medo-Persia, the bronze abdomen represents Greece, the iron legs represents Rome. In the vision of the beasts, the lion with the wings represents Babylon, and the idea of standing on his feet and putting the human heart in him may, in fact, connect us with the incident of Nebuchadnezzar losing his mind and becoming like a beast for a while and then being restored. The bear eating ribs and raised up on one side, some have suggested the raised up on one side represents the fact that the Persian Empire, the Persian side of it is greater than the Median Empire side of it. I would take that to be pure speculation were it not that a later vision, which we're told represents Medo-Persia, has the animal with a big horn on one side and a smaller horn on the other side. And so the Persian side is the big horn. So I think that's probably correct then. The leopard with the four heads is taken to be Greece, and we'll see from this later description in Daniel 8, which we're not going to discuss, that the kingdom there, which we're explicitly told is Greece, is an animal with a single horn in its head, which is broken and replaced by four horns. So presumably the four heads and four wings here represent this fourfold division of the kingdom when the original unified kingdom is damaged, if you like. That presumably leaves Rome then to be the terrible eleven-horned eventually, beast, and we're not going to chase into that further, nor at this point go into the question of liberals' claim that they make the first kingdom, the second kingdom, Media, replace Greece by Persia and Rome by Greece in order to make it come out in the Maccabean period. Off our subject, huh? What we're going to do is, in our discussion now, the Intertestament period, we're going to divide it up in terms of who is in control over Israel at the time of these. Well, Babylon is already off the scene by the time we get to Intertestament. You remember the return is pictured in Zechariah and Haggai, actually in Nehemiah, etc., but I mean the prophets Zechariah and Haggai. So we'll pick up with Medo-Persia, and then Palestine under the Persians or Medo-Persians, and then Palestine under Greece, and then Palestine under Rome, except that there's a brief independence period from Greece to Rome under the Hasmoneans or Maccabees. So we're going to put it in Palestine under the Persians, Palestine under the Greeks, Jewish independence under the Hasmoneans, and then Palestine under Rome. So that's the way we're going to go. So let's take a look at that. So our next category then will be Palestine under the Persians, 539 to 331 BC. And the, what should we say, the dominance of the Persian Empire starts with the rise of Cyrus. Cyrus way back in 559 BC. So this is 30 years before he manages, 20 years before he manages to conquer Babylon, inherits a small kingdom named Anshan, which basically is Persia. He then defeats the Medes in 550, and that gets the Babylonians very concerned about that. The king at that time, Nabonidus, who had been, giving Cyrus some money under the table to support his rebellion against the Medes and trying to weaken the Medes, suddenly realizes that Cyrus, having defeated the Medes, he's now bigger danger than the Medes were. But then Cyrus first moves northwest and takes Asia Minor in 546, and then comes back and takes Babylon in 539. So that's a very quick sketch of the rise of Cyrus. There's a lot more detail, most of which I don't now remember, but I've studied one or another. several important things happen then with the Persians coming into the empire. First of these is the return of the Jews under Cyrus in 539 to 530 BC. Unlike the Assyrians and the Babylonians, Cyrus tries to avoid offending other religions. And unlike the Assyrians and the Babylonians, Cyrus decides to end the deportation policy. Both of those two empires had the idea that the best way to keep a subject people down was to deport their people and scatter them among people of other languages, and that way they were less likely to be able to organize a revolt. Well, Cyrus ended that, and so allowed the various people to return to their territories if they wished to. So the Jews are allowed to return. We see a sketch for us in Ezra chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Not a whole lot of them do, but some do. And so we now begin to have, for the first time in about, what's been not quite 70 years at this point, only about 50 years at this point, Jews are returning now to what we're here calling Palestine. I'm not trying to get into the Palestinian Jewish debate, but basically using that as a generic term for the land, and Israel or the Jews as a term for the people. The second important thing that happened then under the Persians is the rebuilding of the temple, or the building of the second temple in Jewish terminology. Solomon's temple, the first temple, and this temple, the second temple. Cyrus originally allowed the rebuilding to start, but then stopped it due to opposition of neighbors. See a sketch of this in Ezra 6 and in Ezra 4. When Cyrus died, there was an interregnum and some fighting back and forth, and eventually Darius the first here, comes to power in 521 and will reign till 46, so quite a long time of reign. And because the Jews had showed loyalty to Darius at his accession instead of rebelling as many of the other people had, the Jews were allowed to rebuild their temple. And so they began to rebuild their temple starting about 520 or so. And the temple is completed around 515 under the leadership of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, and you see references to that in both of those. And then under the governor Zerubbabel, who was a descendant of David, and the high priest Jeshua, who presumably descended from the high priestly line. So we have the return of the Jews, and they're back in their land now, for the first time in a good many years. It's actually something like 70 years from the first deportation to the first returns, and 70 years from the destruction of the first temple to the building of the second temple. So that's basically, I think, why the captivity is treated as 70 years long. a third event of some significance among the Jews, two events, if you like, are the revival in Judah under Ezra and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem under Nehemiah. These take place during the reign of the Persian king Artaxerxes I, the first of these events back around 4. Artaxerxes begins to reign about 465, and Ezra around 458 is sent from Babylon back to Jerusalem, and he restores the people to observance of the law with the permission of the Persian king. And then some years later, around 445, Nehemiah, who had at that point become the king's cupbearer, so a pretty intimate officer in the royal court, if you like, was sent by the Persian king as governor to rebuild the walls. Rebuilding walls is pretty important. We tend to think of a village as a little town and a city as a big town, but in the time when before airplanes and major artillery and all that sort of thing, the difference between village and town, village and city, was not so much size, it was fortification. So a village might be quite large, but if it was unfortified, it's a village. And a city might be quite small, but if it was not just a fort, if it was a place where lots of people lived and it was fortified, it was a city. So essentially, Jerusalem becomes a city again with the completion of the city walls there in 445 B.C. So those are kind of the three major, what should we say, or four major events of the Persian period, allowing the Jews to return, allowing them to rebuild the city, and then to rebuild the temple, and then the revival in Judah, and the rebuilding of the walls. another rather important event, and we're not sure exactly when this occurs and such, it's much vaguer, is the rise of the Aramaic language as a significant thing in Jewish history. The Aramaic language had been around for a long time before this. It was the old language of the area that has traditionally been called in English Syria, but that's pretty confusing with Syria and Assyria. So the Hebrew word is Aram, and that's being picked up then in some Old Testament circles as well. In any case, it's the upper Euphrates Valley. And the language had been around. You see reference to it in when Laban and Jacob part. They build this pile of stones, and Jacob gives it the Hebrew word for a pile of stones that serves as a witness, which is a technical term for in Hebrew called galid, whereas in apparently in Aramaic there's not. So there's a phrase that is used Jagar Sahadutha or something like that is used to represent this stone of witness, if you like, this cairn of witness, if you like. Well, then after Jacob and Laban's time, that would be, 1800 or something like that B.C., it becomes a diplomatic language of the ancient Near East as Assyria conquers the whole of the Fertile Crescent. they basically adopt Aramaic as the trade language through that area. Babylonians continue it, the Persians continue it, etc. Somewhere along the line, it's adopted by the Jews, and the best guess is it was during the Babylonian exile that some of the Jews put in an area where the people around them didn't speak Hebrew, and yet so obviously a number of them spoke their own native languages, but there was this trade language available. And so they learned to speak Aramaic. In Nehemiah 8, verses 7 and 8, it appears that a lot of the returning Jews from the Babylonian exile at this point, so the sons, grandsons, great-grandchildren, etc., of the people who were exiled, didn't even really know Hebrew anymore. And so there's some translation being given when Nehemiah reads from the law in the situation there back in Israel. We get near the end of the Intertestament period. You begin to get oral translations of the Old Testament into Aramaic for the benefit of people in the synagogue services who could not understand Hebrew. And that stayed oral for a while, and they were called targums, from a verb meaning to translate, basically. And they're still in use at the time of Jesus. And in fact, they become one of the major languages of the rabbinic Talmuds in 400 AD and 550 AD. So that is the Aramaic language, and that is important, and that arose sometime around this Persian period. Another feature of the Persian period, Babylonian into the Persian period, is the rise of the synagogue. The synagogue becomes a place of worship for those unable to attend temple, and it features prayer and Bible study, but no sacrifice. So worship, but a non-sacrificial worship. Date of the origin is obscure. The common view is it's Babylonian captivity, because that's when people didn't have a temple anymore, couldn't go there. There's a couple remarks in the Old Testament that suggest there were places of worship throughout the land that don't appear to be high places, and so may suggest that already, while Israel was still in the land before the captivity, you were still, you know, 2 or 3 days' walk from Jerusalem, and if you wanted to get together or something for worship, there might be some local place to do something like that. So it may even predate the Babylonian exile. We don't know. In any case, we do know that it continued alongside the Second Temple. So the Second Temple stood from 515 BC to 70 AD, and we have this synagogues existing then. One of the rabbinic passages mentions something like there were 100 synagogues in Jerusalem. So, well, you know, what's going on there? Well, obviously, local places of fellowship of some sort. We see from various remarks, including New Testament, that some of those were synagogues for people from particular regions. The synagogue of the freedmen, or synagogue of people from, you know, had come back from Antioch or something of that sort. Well, with the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD, this returns to be the only place of Jewish worship after the destruction of the Second Temple, and that's what it's remained to this day. So the various Jewish places of worship that you see scattered around the world, even though they may be called temple something or another in some places, they are in fact synagogues of one sort or another. Well, we've got one more topic to say a word or two about under the Persian period, and that is the intertestament temples. The rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple takes place here, and that's called, as I say, among the Jews, the Second Temple, or the Second Jerusalem Temple, built 515, destroyed by the Romans 70 AD. That was the Orthodox temple, in the sense that stay with the biblical views of the nature of God, that sort of thing, and continued the Mosaic regulation in one way or another. However, somewhere along the line, a temple was developed up in the area we call Samaria, and often called the Mount Gerizim Temple, because it was situated on one of the two mountains in which the Israelites at the covenant renewal ceremonies every 7 years, one group was to stand on one mountain and the other on this mountain, and one shouts the blessings and the other shouts the curses, etc. The date of its building is uncertain. Suggestions 450 BC down to 330 BC, somewhere in that period. built by the Samaritans, but picked up some help from priests who were unhappy with what was going on in Jerusalem and came north, etc. It was destroyed by the Hasmoneans or Maccabees, 128 BC, but is still a holy site in New Testament times. John 4:20, you can see the woman says, here on this mountain we worship, etc. And that's what, perhaps around 30 AD or something of that sort. And yet it was still then viewed as holy then. And it's still viewed as holy today. There's a small group of Samaritans that still exist. I don't know the current numbers. They were down to a few hundred in the stuff I'd seen from the 70s. So still have worship activities there, actually still have a Passover service there, and still have sacrifice there. So they had continued sacrificing off and on, at least, through the intervening period, but we're talking about one sacrifice a year versus, at least two a day in the Jerusalem temple. Besides these two temples, there's a temple developed in Egypt, which is usually called the Elephantine Temple, to distinguish it from a temple further north in Egypt. And this seems to have been founded perhaps around 525 BC and lasts to about 390. We have records of this really only from papyri that has survived from that period. I think that it was built for the benefit of Jewish soldiers who had been hired as mercenaries, or perhaps enslaved as mercenaries, by the Persians when they conquered Egypt. And so they lived here down. Down or up, depends on whether you're thinking of a map. It's south on the map, but up the Nile River at the first cataract on the Nile, the Elephantine. They lived there. They might have been some refugees from the time of Manasseh. We don't know. There are some hints that they were probably polytheistic, that they're carrying on some of the troubles that were going on. We see already in Jeremiah, where Jeremiah comments that the Jews that had taken him down into Egypt, they were still worshiping the Queen of Heaven. And so apparently that is something of that sort that is going on here. I mentioned one other temple, which actually comes from later than the Persian period, but since this is where we're going to discuss the temples, we'll stick it in here. That's the later Leontopolis Temple, also in Egypt, founded about 160 BC and then destroyed by the Romans in 72 AD. It was built in the Maccabean period by a high priest named Onias III, who had been bumped out of the priesthood by Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll come back and talk about him later. And so this fellow fled to Egypt, and a temple was built down there by probably the Egyptian Jewish community. But after the Jewish War, the Romans did not want any places that would function as a center for rebellion against Rome, and so they destroyed it. Well, that is a very quick tour of Palestine under the Persians. We turn to look then at Palestine under the Greeks from about 331 BC to about 160 BC. That's the period when the Maccabees will eventually get their independence from the remains of the Greek empire. We start with Alexander, later known as Alexander the Great, who rules from about 336 to 329 BC. He was the son of a Macedonian ruler named Philip, and his father Philip was assassinated when Alexander was only 20 years old, not assassinated by Alexander, and yet Alexander at age 20 had already had some experience as a general in Philip's army, and so within a couple years he was able to establish his control of his father's kingdom. And one of the projects his father had had, Philip had had, was Philip identified himself as a Greek, even though he was Macedonian, the territory north of Greece, and so did Alexander. One of Philip's projects he had in mind was to revenge the Greeks against the Persians, who had invaded a century or so earlier than that, century and a half earlier than that. So once Alexander's got control of Macedon and Greece again, he invades Asia Minor in 334 BC with only 35,000 men. Well, that sounds like a lot of men, but when the Persians had invaded Greece a century and a half before, they had had over 1 million men, according to the historians. So what are you going to do with 35,000 men? Well, certainly one advantage was the Persians themselves were back in their empire 1,000 miles away, and they had lots of soldiers in Asia Minor, but they were all garrison troops scattered over, 50 or 100 fortified areas, so not easy to collect them. Alexander was able to win a victory that year at the Granicus River in western Asia Minor, and that really opened Asia Minor to his taking control of the area. There were a lot of Greeks living in Asia Minor, and they weren't happy with the Persians, and there were a lot of other people living there. The Persians were not the native people there. So Alexander was able to get a lot of support once he won this crucial battle. And so then he had about a year to consolidate his control in Asia Minor and then head east. According to Herodotus, I believe it is, the story is he went to a place, a Gordian, where there was a chariot with a elaborate knot on the tang of the chariot to hook the yoke of the crossbar to it. And there was a legend that whoever could untie this knot would become ruler of the world. Well, Alexander fooled around with it for a few minutes and was clearly having no success. Alexander was not an example of patience, whipped out his sword and whacked through the rope and said, who knows whether he actually said this or not, thus I untie all Gordian knots or something of that sort. Well, he does come to conquer the world, as understood at the time. So the next battle is at Issus on the other end of Asia Minor, and by this time the Persians have pulled together a big army and come to fight him, and there's a big battle at Issus, and Alexander wins in a spectacular way, and as a result, that opens Syria, Palestine, and Egypt to him. The Persian king barely escapes. His royal family actually do not escape. They are taken captive and has to go all the way back to the capital of Persia to put together another army again. So Alexander's got a couple years, and he then comes down and takes Palestine and Egypt and such. Rather interesting incident there, which liberals fiercely deny, but Josephus says it really occurred, that Alexander was not too happy with the Jews because the high priest had refused to send him troops as he was taking northern Syria, because the king's high priest said he had made a vow to the king of Persia that he would not fight against the king of Persia. So Alexander, not terribly happy, was headed that way, and high priest put on his dress robes, we'll say, and had everybody pray, and a procession of people went out to meet Alexander. And when Alexander met them, Alexander said he had seen this man in a dream when he was back in Greece, and told that he should, treat him well, etc. And then, according to Josephus, Alexander was shown the prophecies in Daniel about him. And that, of course, is not popular in liberal circles, since they think that Daniel wasn't written for another 150 years. But in any case, that's the story. And what isn't any speculation about is that Alexander, for some reason, treated the Jews very, very well and didn't treat the people around them all that well. So, there we are. Anyway, Alexander then finally wins after he's taken Greece, and there's a story about Egypt. There's a story about Egypt as well, that Alexander goes out to Amun in the desert in Egypt, west of the Nile. There's a oracle there, and that he receives a favorable oracle again that he will control the world. So how many of these stories are true? We don't have time machines, okay? So anyway, in 331, he has now moved towards Persia's center, if you like, and there's a big battle at Gaugamela, and here Alexander's army destroys the Persian army, destroys the Persian empire, and the Persian king heads for cover toward the eastern end of his empire, and Alexander and his troops follow them, and eventually, just before they catch up with him, the people following the Persian king assassinate him and surrender to Alexander. Alexander has, delusions of empire. That's probably not a bad approximation, and decides to conquer as much land as he can. But his troops finally, when they get into what we now call India, said enough. And so they head back to Babylon, and Alexander dies in Babylon at age 33, having conquered all this territory. Well, Alexander's agenda had been to conquer as much of the world as he could, but also to mix the Eastern and Western cultures and to spread Greek ideas and attitudes and such all over his conquered territory, including the Greek language. That's Alexander. Well, Alexander is dead now in 323 at age 33, and that brings us to a struggle for succession. Alexander's son is still a baby. Alexander's death. Alexander's brother is mentally incompetent. So the generals under Alexander band together to try to keep the throne for the son. But they fall to fighting each other. And while all of this is going on, the brother dies, the baby dies. And once the baby is dead, then there's nothing to stop a winner-takes-all thing if it can possibly be worked out. Well, it never works out that way. There's not a sufficiently dominant winner to take everything. So eventually the empire is broken to several pieces. These are usually counted as four. Lysimachus taking the area of Thrace north of Macedon. Cassander taking Macedon. Seleucus taking a big piece, Asia Minor and Mesopotamia, so, a whole big swath of there. And Ptolemy taking Syria and Egypt. Well, for Jewish background, it's only these latter two, Seleucus in the north and Ptolemy in the south, that will be important. It's only those two that come to dominate Israel at one time or another. Well, that brings us to the Ptolemaic dynasty, which continues to 30 BC when Cleopatra commits suicide, but has control of Palestine only from 301 BC to 198 BC. While the various generals are fighting for control, there's one point when a fifth general, whom we've not mentioned here, named Antigonus, looks like he might get the whole thing, but the other generals gang up on him. If you've ever played the war game Risk, you realize that sometimes it's necessary to do things like that to keep one person from winning the game. And that's basically what the generals do. And while the generals are out fighting Antigonus, Ptolemy sneaks in and grabs off Palestine. Ptolemy is noted for reasonably favorable treatment of the Jews, both in Palestine and also the Jews who have wound up in Egypt, because a large number of Jews had settled in Alexandria by this time. There are still some problems here and there, but that's basically the situation. And that's from a little over a century, 301 to 198. The Seleucid dynasty does not continue as long. It falls to Rome in 63 BC, but it does control Palestine from 198 BC to about 160. The rulers of the Ptolemies are pretty invariably called Ptolemy, and the historians today call them Ptolemy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but in antiquity, they all had a second nickname. So Ptolemy Soter, Ptolemy the Savior, if you like, not understood quite in Christian terms. Ptolemy Fatso, that was another name, that probably not to his face, but various of those. The Seleucid rulers tended to have two or three names that you see rotate back and forth. One of them is Seleucus and one of them is Antiochus. In the long series of wars, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, the Seleucids finally get Palestine from the Ptolemies. And then we jump on to, 6th, 8th, 9th ruler of the Seleucids is a fellow called Antiochus IV, known better as Antiochus Epiphanes. He viewed himself as a manifestation of the god Zeus. The Jews called him Antiochus Epimenes, crackpot or something of that sort, madman. Anyway, he favored Hellenistic Jews. Stop and back up for a moment. The Ptolemaic dynasty controlled Egypt, which consisted primarily of Egyptians, some Jews and others in Alexandria primarily, and then the Greeks overall. And you didn't have so much ethnic diversity that was a huge problem. But in the Seleucid dynasty, which covered all these different nationalities through Asia Minor and down the Tigris-Euphrates River and almost over to India, you did. And so the Seleucids, in trying to unify their empire, tried to push Hellenism on all the people who wanted to cooperate with the empire and become wealthy and that sort of thing. So when Antiochus IV becomes Seleucid ruler, he favors the Hellenistic faction among the Jews in Jerusalem. and they, perhaps fawning on him to a certain extent, want to establish Jerusalem as a Hellenistic city, which will be named Antioch, okay? And he permits that, right? Well, that's pretty much a disaster to the Orthodox Jews to have that happen. We will come back to the problem in there, because that will eventually lead to the Maccabean Revolt. Antiochus IV will later attempt, around 168 B.C., to abolish Judaism. And we'll discuss all that in our next section. Huh? Well, so that's a little bit of the infighting and such that leads to the spread of Alexander's empire over almost all the Middle East. Then it's breaking into pieces with his death, and then the pieces fighting it out, and particularly northern piece, the Seleucids, over and fighting the southern piece, the Ptolemies, for the control of Israel, Palestine, whatever you want to call it. A very important feature of this time period, then, in regard to Israel, the Jewish background, is Hellenism. Hellenism comes from the Greek word helos, which is the Greek's own name for Greece, okay? Our name, Greece, comes from the Latin and comes from the name of that the Romans had given to some Greeks living down on the bottom of the Italian boot. They called them Graeke. Yeah, well, I'm not sure how the ending goes there. Graecus, I guess. Hellenism means Greek-like. And so it's the name for Greek culture as it develops in the East after Alexander. So an attempt to Grecianize the Syrian culture, the Jewish culture, the Egyptian culture, etc., would be Hellenism, if you like. Well, that obviously had a significant influence on Judaism, so that by New Testament times, we see Ptolemy as a pretty thoroughly Hellenized Jew. Josephus is a slightly Hellenized Jew, and there were guys further over than Philo, if you like. It appears perhaps that Hellenism was somewhat influenced by Judaism, and that's argued over some. But one of the features of Hellenism was what should we say, historians of religion call syncretism. Comes from a verb in Greek meaning to mix. So syncretism is a place where two, three, four religions come in contact and their ideas get mixed with one another. Probably the commonest idea right around us in the last decade or century anyway has been the New Age movement, which is a syncretism between Christianity and, say, Buddhism or Hinduism, adopting elements from each, if you like, would be an example of that. you see it very much in the Syrian temple at Baalbek in Lebanon today, where I had a chance to visit that just before things fell apart in 1975 or 6, whenever they fell apart. I was there in 4. And that was a temple that was on the site of Baal worship, and that's where the name Baalbek came from, the Baal of the Bekaa Valley, okay? But when the Greeks came in, the god Baal had been re-identified as Zeus, and then when the Romans came in, the god Baal Zeus had been re-identified as Jupiter, etc., and so you had all of that sort of thing going on. That probably even is explanation for some of your polytheisms that you see around the world, is that two cultures have come together, one has a chief goddess, one has a chief god, and they do some compromise or something. We don't know. We weren't back there, don't have time machines, but certainly something of that sort has happened in history. Well, that's obviously going to cause a problem for the Jews then, when Hellenism is pushed in any religious way in Palestine, and there's certainly people willing to do that. there are, of course, various schools of philosophy back in Greece, and those come to have influence in the East as well. We, of course, hear of Paul in Acts speaking at the Areopagus in Athens and talks about the Epicureans and such, and the Stoics. And Josephus is... Philo is influenced by Stoic and Platonic-type ideas, the early Christians, particularly the early Christian philosopher theologians, are influenced by Stoicism and such as well. I'm not going to give you a tour of those philosophies right here. But much of the impact of Hellenism in the East was the political benefits. that when Alexander's successors took all these areas, they were going to basically refound a lot of the existing cities as Greek cities. And in a Greek city, the people who had the impact were the citizens. Citizens weren't just people who lived in the city, though they did need to do that in general. They were people who had the right to vote in some sense, who had the right to hold offices, etc., in the city. And there would be lots of other people in the city who were just resident aliens or slaves or something of that sort that were much the lower levels, etc. So if you're a Jewish boy and you want to get ahead and you're living in Alexandria or you're living in Antioch or something of that sort, there'll be a temptation at least to adopt whatever features of Hellenism are needed in order to be acceptable in the society. So we see that going on. Somehow, for instance, Paul's family had become Roman citizens, and they were already citizens of Tarsus. So somewhere back, several generations back up the line, his family had been important enough to get citizenship in Tarsus and then citizenship in Rome. And that may have had to do with the fact that perhaps that there were tent makers and that the Romans needed tent makers for their campaigns. I have no idea just how that might have happened. But the effect was such that Paul was born a citizen, whereas as the military officer there in Jerusalem had to buy his citizenship. Obviously not as prestigious at that point. So Hellenism is pretty important, and we're going to see that in connection with the whole Hasmonean revolt. Another important feature of the Greek period here in Israel is the translation of the Bible into Greek, what we call the Septuagint translation of the Bible into Greek. The version got started probably around 250 B.C., so less than a century after Alexander had taken the area. We have a work we call the Letter of Aristeus, which comes probably from about a century after that, and it gives us a narrative of the origin of the Septuagint. We're told here that Ptolemy II, so the second ruler down in Egypt of the Greek people who came to control Egypt after the death of Alexander, wanted to build a library, wanted to build the biggest library in the world. And so he got this fellow for his librarian, and the librarian told him that they were trying to collect all kinds of works to put in the library, and the librarian said, well, we should have a copy of the Jews' Law. And apparently, according to his story at least, it did not exist in Greek at that point. And so Ptolemy funded sending delegates up to Jerusalem to get 72 Jewish elders who would come down to Egypt and translate the law. So the story goes then that they did come down, and they translated the law, and the result was the Septuagint translation. However, the story gets better, if you like, as time goes on. Some of the later additions to the story is that the translation covers the whole of the Old Testament, though in fact, as the Letter of Aristeus goes, it calls it the Jewish Law. And that's a little tricky, because the term law could mean the whole Old Testament, or it might just mean the Torah, the Pentateuch, if you like. a later addition that surely would have shown up in the Letter of Aristeus, if it were true, is that the translators divided into 36 pairs and worked independently, and they produced 36 identical versions of the story of the Old Testament, which probably lies behind the idea that a number of people had that the translation itself was an inspired translation. There's some skepticism regarding the details of the story, and particularly the later editions, but the general opinion of the story today is that the translation into Greek that we call the Septuagint was apparently made at Alexandria, which is where the story puts it, and that the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, appears to have been translated as a unit and was probably around 250 B.C. So we've got a pretty unified style all through that in the way of handling different translation matters there, which is not the case for many of the other Greek parts of the Old Testament as we have it. The scrolls may well have come from Jerusalem, and possibly the translators too, and that has to do with some details about the text of the Old Testament, working out matters regarding a Babylonian-type version of the Old Testament and a Jerusalem version and a Samaritan version and things of that sort. And given the date 250, then presumably Ptolemy II allowed the work, and he may have given aid to it. So so we're in a situation, again, without any time machines, but it looks like at least a substantial amount of the story is true. The Septuagint translation of the Bible is very, very important for a number of reasons. It appears to be the longest translation of any ancient writing known in antiquity. Rather striking. It gives the text of the Old Testament a century or so before the oldest Hebrew text that we have for most of the Old Testament. It set the pattern for Greek theological terms as used in the New Testament as well as in the Old Testament. Put the Old Testament in the universal language of the Mediterranean world at that time, at least of the East Mediterranean world at that time. And it became the Old Testament of the early church. Once the gospel spread substantially beyond Israel, the majority of people were not native Hebrew speakers.